Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com. This week on Meat & Three, we're exploring food for the eyes, how the art and culinary worlds collide.
It's incredibly elaborate. It's a feast for the eyes, a banquet dinner with garnished ham, turkey, and an array of accompaniments.
We shot baguettes with like paint dripping off of them with the blue, white, and red from the French flag.
Oh, what did a student tell me? They said, the camera eats first. And it's so true. It's so true.
Tune in to Meat & Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Coralie. Carol Pack is the founder of America's first and perhaps only canned craft makgeolli maku. Maku comes in a variety of flavors, and all are so elegantly fizzy, cloudy, and low in ABV, all buzzwords we've kind of grown to seek out when enjoying a craft beverage. Makgeolli might be our next trend beverage, which is what I'm hoping to find with Carol today. But where do you begin introducing a beverage with ancient history to a new market? Welcome to the show, Carol.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's start with what makgeolli is for those who are unfamiliar with it and how you were introduced to it.
Okay. So makgeolli is Korea's oldest known alcohol. It dates back to, people say 2000 BC, some people say even before. But I think if you look at the history of different countries, like beer was a natural byproduct of necessity. You know, when grain was plentiful, malt, barley, and other countries adapted a similar beverage. So like in the UK, they used ciders to make hard cider because they didn't have grains. And then Korea, they used rice because that's plentiful in Asia. Mm-hmm. I think most Koreans who come from a somewhat traditional Korean family know what makgeolli is because either your grandparents or your parents or your parents' friends are drinking it. And when you go to Korean restaurants or bars, it's always kind of scattered around the dinner table. And I also go back and forth from here to Korea, and I see it a lot. The people drink it everywhere in Korea. So, yeah, it's in a signature PET 750 milliliter bottle, and you can't really miss it because it looks like nothing else. It's not a glass bottle. It's not in a can. And it's also white, so it's, you know, I guess nigori sake is that, but before I ever knew what nigori sake was, I always knew what makgeolli was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you say that you saw your parents and your grandparents drinking it, and can you talk about, like, some of your early associations with the drink? Like, is it very sweet? Is it, what is kind of the vibe when you're drinking makgeolli?
Yeah. So I never drank it with my parents, but I started to drink it with my friends, and I just knew that it was a less popular drink. We would always kind of drink soju with my friends, and I always wondered why we didn't drink more makgeolli, because it tasted, to me, much better than soju. But in Asian culture, it's kind of like group drinking, so you're either getting, even the beers, it comes in sharing sizes. So you're kind of ordering as a group. So if everyone else wants soju or beer or something else, you know, the packaging of a makgeolli is a 750 milliliter bottle, and it's too much for one person to consume alone. Mm-hmm. And I think really the only time I would drink makgeolli is there's a tradition in Korea where you drink makgeolli and eat tajan when it rains. And so, I would have select friends who they like to enjoy the taste of their food and alcohol. Mm-hmm. And they would always suggest, oh, let's go get makgeolli today because mm-hmm. it's raining.
every time it rains. That's such a sweet kind of tradition to uphold. So, not only does it come in big, hard-to-share bottles, but it's also usually sweetened and comes in many flavors like peach and, you know, grape or whatever, right? So can you talk about why people are more resistant to drinking that when it comes, or like choosing that or, you know, like a soju?
Actually, I wasn't introduced to the other flavors of makgeolli until pretty recently. Even in Korea, it's kind of like beer where there's a large range. So it's usually just that one traditional rice flavor, but it could be different levels of alcohol, different amounts of sweetness, dryness. There's a really fundamental ingredient called nuruk, which is like a kind of like kombucha SCOBY. It's a live culture natural product of Korea, and it has a very funky, earthy flavor, kind of what you get from natural wine. Mm-hmm. So there, depending on what kind of nuruk you use, either a wheat-based or a rice-based, and how much of it you use, it really changes the flavor of makgeolli as well. Mm-hmm. So, it's typically just one flavor, but different styles. And then... Sorry, I forgot your second question.
That's okay. Yeah, let's actually get into the history of makgeolli. So can you explain how it was kind of like a farmer's alcohol, mm-hmm. and kind of like the current revival today and how there's more interest in craft?
Yeah. I think it was, you know, because back in the day, everyone were farmers, right? No matter what country, that was how... you live and survive, and you cultivate by planting and farming. And I think it was natural. Maybe we got the idea from like a neighboring country, but people just started to brew. And I think when meals were scarce, it was cheaper to drink alcohol. And because it's made from rice and it's coarsely filtered and there's rice sediment, it was used as a substitute for meals. It was very refreshing. It helped you through like the labor. And it was also a social thing to like bring people together. And at break time, people would just kind of gather around and drink that. It wasn't only for the farmers. It was for the normal people. It was for the royals and the kings. In Korea, it's segregated into like wonju and takju and cheongju. And when you let the rice settle, the bottom was kind of for the commoner or the lay people. Mm. And the top, the clear part, which was more rare, that was for like the richer people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And does the clear spirit differ from soju? That's completely different.
Yes.
Okay.
So if you distill the clear part, which I believe is called cheongju, it becomes soju.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay. And so in the 80s, and this happens across Asia, not just in Korea, but there is this kind of influx of Western culture and Western tastes. And so there kind of was this, pushback or decreased interest in Asian spirits. Right. And so can you talk about what caused the reintroduction of Asian spirits or the interest in it recently?
Before that, I think during the Korean War, there was a shortage of rice. So the Korean government placed a ban on people making alcohol with rice. Hmm. So that's when makgeolli became substituted with other kinds of grains, potatoes, corn. And I think the quality of the drink fell, and I'm not sure when it became, but traditionally you steam rice and you add nuruk and you ferment it with nuruk to make makgeolli. But nowadays the commercial products, it's made with either rice flour, rice flavorings, raw rice. And there became kind of like common knowledge that makgeolli is the hangover drink. So it has a stigma of being the poor people's drink, the farmer's drink, the old people's drink, and kind of the hangover drink. Mm. So,
and that's because of like the fillers, or
that's what I'm guessing.
Okay.
I also think people never really just drink makgeolli. It's kind of like the topper at the end when you're drinking too much of something else, and then you kind of change to something lighter, mm-hmm. and then like you and with that, and that you just kind of, wherever the stigma came from, it just kind of confirmed, like, oh yeah, it does give me a hangover. Mm-hmm. So because there was also no innovation done over time, it's kind of like if craft beer never happened here, like who knows what would happen with the state of beer now.
Yeah.
Like most of the breweries in Korea, it's kind of been passed down like generation to generation, and it's always kind of the son who is doing the same exact thing that his parents or grandparents have done and doesn't really care to innovate or change either the packaging or the taste and keep up with the trends. So I think while the older people still drink it, the younger people, you know, it was never like remade for their times. And then they also had this introduction of all these other drinks. So it was kind of like the culmination of two.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like Korea, especially South Korea, because it's grown so quickly as a country, like after the Korean War and like where it is now, it's a very like sophisticated country and, you know, pretty rich, high GDP. So I think Koreans now always try to mimic whatever's happening in like the U.S. or the Western counterparts of the world. And that's what's kind of like cool. That's mm-hmm. what they aspire to be.
Mm-hmm.
But I something I can't figure out is why like soju has that staying power.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you're saying younger brewers in Korea are kind of mimicking what's going on in the U.S. and like, are they mimicking like the craft approach to Makgeolli, and so they're kind of reinventing like that process? Or
Okay, so I actually didn't address that part. I was just saying that there's a lot of imports now. So people drink, they have all these alternatives now, whereas long time ago it was just like whatever was in the country. But yeah, there was a resurgence of Makgeolli, I think, for several reasons. Mostly because I think it was a dying industry and the government wanted to put a big push behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So they put a lot of financial incentives for Makgeolli breweries. They decreased the taxes. They sponsored a bunch of like celebrities to push it. Kind of like, this is our alcohol. This is healthy for you because it has all these like lactobacillus, and it's good for your gut and it's good for your skin, and that helped, I guess, like bring it back a little bit. And I also think like innovators were starting to notice like, oh, there's only these large commercial brands. Like, can I go back and bring Makgeolli to its roots and like reintroduce this drink as like this beautiful product that's like has so much history and tradition behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's people who their parents do not just like hand down Makgeolli recipe and brewery to them. They learned it on their own. They experimented. They built their own facilities and brand. And now there's craft Makgeolli bars kind of throughout the country. And it's slowly growing every year. But I don't know too much because there's no data. There's no numbers. And it's really anecdotal just by like, because I go to Korea twice a year and I just look around and I talk to people and owners, and it's kind of from what they tell me that they see a growing interest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So would you consider yourself as part of this new wave?
I think so, but I don't think that what I'm doing here in the U.S. will impact what's going on in Korea. I was more inspired from what was going on in Korea and thought like, oh, maybe I could do that, but in the U.S. Because I found myself missing the Makgeollis that I was drinking in Korea, and I couldn't find it in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, what's out in the market now is kind of a second iteration of Makgu. The first one we were brewing locally, and it tasted a little bit more like traditional Makgeolli because it had a strong Nuruk flavor and it wasn't fully pasteurized, and it was super handmade. But there were so many issues, like no one knows what they're doing here. It was hard to find a scalable brewery. I couldn't afford or had the time to build my own. Mm-hmm. And so now we went back to Korea to partner with a larger Makgeolli brewery, and I just kind of worked with them to tweak a recipe that was middle ground between like a commercial Makgeolli and a traditional Makgeolli, because mm-hmm. I also wanted a taste that was very accessible and approachable for someone who's never had it before. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is Meant to Be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be back after a short break.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on an eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
And we're back. So we were just talking about the Makgeolli process. So let's get into that. What was your first batch like? Did you make it at home?
Yes. So at first I went to Korea before starting Makgeolli, and I visited a bunch of Makgeolli breweries, the larger ones, the smaller ones. So I had a range of kind of like the techniques, the possible ways to mm-hmm. make Makgeolli. There was the real traditional way where you steam rice and you ferment it. And then there was kind of like a cheating way, which was like using rice flour or using like raw rice. So just to get a feel for all three, I've tried all three.
Mm-hmm. Actually, could you explain how the raw rice or the rice flour is cheating and like what kind of process you bypass?
Well, you're not actually steaming the rice. So rice flour, you're kind of like, it's kind of like the Betty Crocker cake mix mm-hmm. versus like making your own cake. From scratch. Mm-hmm. So you just get the rice flour and you mix it with water mm-hmm. and then you add like Nuruk and like a lot of ferment and with water. And then with raw rice, you also skip the steaming of the rice, but the reason you steam rice is so I don't know. This is like, I haven't brewed for so long that I forgot. But you're kind of softening the outside of the rice so you can get like everything inside of the rice, mm-hmm. like the enzymes and everything to break down. The raw rice, you don't steam it. You're just using enzymes and like really strong, enzymes to like break down the rice. So it's kind of the same, but it's kind of like using science to speed things up. Mm-hmm. And I can taste the difference. It just tastes like not as deep of a flavor. I think in the most general terms. Mm-hmm. I still know the name of every culture now. I forgot everything.
So then you tried the three processes and you determined which to be the best.
Well, none of them were working for me.
Okay, yeah.
And then I asked someone who brews other things and tried to experiment with him and had him do it on his own, and he couldn't get anywhere either. Mm-hmm. So then I actually didn't ask my mom, but one day she was like, oh, do you want me to brew a batch for you? And I was like, sure. And we lived separately at the time, so I went home one day and she was like, oh, this is the Makgeolli I made, do you want to try it? And I tried it and it was so good. And I was like, okay, mom, like, this is going to be our recipe. So from then on, I did about 10 to 15 batches with her, just trying to tweak. I wanted to try different Nurek's different rice, different ratios of water, because what you made was good, but I just wanted to compare, like, different recipes. Mm-hmm. And then we had a really solid recipe, but then looking for a brewery to scale that recipe was impossible, mm-hmm. because making makgeolli is kind of a hybrid of, makgeolli at least, is a hybrid of, like, what you need in a beer brewery and a sake brewery. Like, you need something to steam large amounts of rice, and then you're brewing with all the rice inside, and just transferring all that rice from one vessel to another. There was just no brewery that could handle that. And then the sake breweries, they didn't have like anything to carbonate the makgeolli. They didn't have the right filtering equipment. They didn't have the right canning or packaging equipment. They didn't have pasteurizing equipment. So I tried to take the recipe to at least 20 breweries. And all of them were suggesting, oh, if you could tweak the recipe in this way, maybe we could do it. Mm-hmm. And if you tried to tweak it in this way. So, you know, some of them suggested us go back to rice flour. Some suggested, you know, this and this. And even steaming rice, that's the traditional way, but some were like, if you cook the rice, maybe we can make it work. Mm-hmm. So then we went back and tried maybe a dozen or so more times to make that kind of recipe, and it just tasted really off compared to what we initially had.
Mm-hmm. Is that cooking, like, boiling rice versus steaming it? Or
right, or okay. Or using, so we tried boiling rice, we tried a pressurized cooker, we used mm-hmm. a rice cooker, mm-hmm. we used like steaming in different methods too, because it all requires like different amounts of water, mm-hmm. and eventually we decided to just go with the original recipe and then figure out everything after the liquid after. So, like, the sake breweries, the techniques are pretty similar to making a nigori sake, except sake uses koji opposed to the nuruk. And after a sake is made, it's also not diluted down. So we were like, okay, we could work with that. But then we had a lot of difficulty finding a sake brewery because koji does not have any wild cultures in it, but Nuruk does. Mm-hmm. So anything large, any large brewery, they don't want any kind of cross-contamination. So finding a brewery was like a year-long process. But eventually we were able to find a brewery that was able to make the liquid for us. And then I would drive up to Maine every time we brewed a batch, and we would just manually strain the liquid, put it in filler guns and can the liquid. Mm-hmm. We would stick the label on with our hands. We would steam it. And then we would dunk it in, like, a hot bath to pasteurize it. And then we would palletize it all manually. So I knew it wasn't, like, a scalable process, but I wanted to at least put something in the market. Because even I was trying to front-load a lot of, like, oh, well, people buy from us. But it's a different mindset when you're putting something out in, like, a glass with, like, a tape on it versus an actual, like, quote-unquote product.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to get to that point. Mm-hmm. And I've heard so many times, not only from, like, alcohol brands or beverage brands, but also food products where, oh, something can taste so good in your kitchen, but if you scale it, it's completely different.
Right.
So I didn't want to blindly test and retest recipes when it was going to taste so different when it was scaled up. But that actually didn't turn out to be what happened. It tasted exactly like what it was like in the kitchen. But yeah, the first batch, it was totally off. So we had, I want to say, 10 to 15,000 cans, and we just gave it away.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure what went wrong, to be honest. I think it was like a mismeasurement or, but there was almost no sediment. It was pretty dry. And it was really, really tasty. That is exactly what I would sell as a rice beer. but then it wasn't makgu. Mm-hmm. So we gave that batch away. Then we did a second batch, and the second batch, which was much better, but half of it got damaged in transportation to our warehouse in Jersey. So yeah, it took a year and a half to get a product out in the market. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so yeah, let's actually talk about the decision to call it rice beer. Why rice beer? Why not, you know, Nigori sake-like drink? Like, mm-hmm. how can you talk about the process of deciding how to market?
Yeah. So I first looked at the imported makgeolis and saw what they were called, and it was a wine product, mm-hmm. at least in New York. And that's kind of like the wines you see in Duane Reade. It's like very cheap stuff. It's not real wine, or it's wine with all these added ingredients. And I just didn't feel comfortable with having makgeolis be a wine product. Mm-hmm. But then when I submitted my ingredients and my brewing process to the TTB, which is like the regulatory arm of alcohol in the U.S., akin to like, it's kind of like a FDA for food. Mm-hmm. They were like, oh, okay, this is actually a rice wine slash sake. Hmm. And I was like, okay, like this isn't a sake, but sure. I understand that there's like, we're kind of like the first people to do this, so we can like figure that out later. But there was a couple of challenges with us being a sake. The first one was finding a facility that had the licenses for to brew a sake, because I wanted to find a brewery in New York after my experience in Maine, just like me driving back and forth to Maine in a single day and like bringing people along with me. It was mm-hmm. crazy. So I wanted to find something nearby, but I realized it was really hard to find a brewery that had licenses to brew sake, because you need kind of to be licensed to make both a wine and a beer, at least in New York. And then secondly, in New York, you can only sell like wine in wine stores. But then all the other makgeolis were in Korean marts because it was a wine product. Mm-hmm. And you're allowed to sell wine product alongside a beer and cider and things like that. But so I would do tastings and I would be in wine stores. But I would see that people were there to buy wine. And it just mm-hmm. kind of felt like, how can I convince them if they're looking for wine for a dinner party to buy something like so far off from what they're looking mm-hmm. for? I really want to be sold in like Whole Foods and I want to be sold in H Marts. And so I was like, okay, how can I like overcome this hurdle of being a rice wine? And on top of that, everyone was calling me a sake. And it was really frustrating because I'm like, I wanted to bring a product from Korea, and mm-hmm. I don't want people to think this is sake. So I looked into the definition of beer, which is like a fermentable grain or an acceptable alternative with or without the addition of hops. So I looked into the definition of acceptable grains, and one was rice, and so I kind of wrote back to the TTB saying, hey, we're a fermented rice without hops, so I think we should be a beer. And also, before Mako, I was working at ZX Ventures, which is a part of Anheuser-Busch, and my mindset for a year was beer and beer occasions and just looking like, oh, it's 6%. It's fermented. It's a social drink. It's a light, easy, casual drink. And all these beer alternatives were similarly like, you know, like hard seltzers, hard ciders, hard sodas, hard kombuchas. It was pretty similar, like fruity flavors, sparkling. It's for social events. It's low in ABV. So I just thought it made the most sense to be on those shelves. Mm-hmm. So they got back to me and said, okay, sure, like you can be a rice beer. Mm-hmm. So that's where we are now. We still have our challenges because now when I'm selling in a craft beer bar and someone's expecting a beer and they try us, they're like, this is good, but this isn't beer. Mm. So I guess they feel like we're misleading them. So yeah, my whole month, month's focus has been, do I call ourselves Amakgali beer? Mm-hmm. Do I keep pushing it as a rice beer? Do I push it as a Korean beer? People also say, like, rice beer is really unappealing because usually that's, like, a cheap substitute for grains and, like, barley and things like that. So that's kind of where we are. Like, yeah. I've been doing a lot of focus groups around this recently.
Yeah, so kind of what is a clue or what are you looking for in the market that will kind of give you that push to go with Makgali or rice beer?
Because my whole hypothesis is if someone doesn't know what Makgali is, they won't be, like, inclined to try it if it's on a shelf. So at least if it's, like, a Korean beer, they're like, oh, it's from another country. Oh, I'm familiar with, like, Korean food or Korean music or Korean beauty. They associate it with high quality from what I've gathered from, like, interviews. Mm-hmm. So, and if people try Makgali, there's a high likelihood they like it. Mm-hmm. So for me, whatever it takes for them to want to try it. Mm-hmm. And I feel like they'd rather want to try a Korean beer or a Korean rice beer than a Makgali, which is, like, I don't know. I have no idea what that is. Yeah.
So you're saying the first batch was, like, pretty funky and, like, good. You liked it, but you don't think maybe the market's yet ready for that. So how do you balance, like, accessibility with affordability and, like, what's being true to Makgali and what you want it to be?
Yeah. Well, I think Makgali is that. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had some parties where really hardcore, diehard Makgali lovers will come. And I see their face. They're like, okay, this is so whatever. Mm. But for me, I wanted to, because the current Makgalis in the market are good. They're very drinkable. But people don't understand. They don't read the label where it has, like, 15 ingredients that you don't know. I don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. A lot of times
you're talking about the ones, like, in the plastic bottles.
Exactly. Okay. All the imported ones.
Mm-hmm. And those are, like, $2 for a bottle versus, like, Makgali's, like, $3 a can, right?
Exactly. Okay. And it's half the quantity.
Mm-hmm.
And the branding is just not gonna go anywhere beyond the Korean community because it's tacky. It's very tacky. And I think it's pretty affordable right now. I tried to price it akin to, like, a premium craft beer, and that's where we are right now. And so I didn't even think about my own margins. I went from this is what I want the price to consumer to be, and it worked backwards. And I was like, oh, can I make a business with like my cost of this, and we're positive for now. and you know, I already talked to our brewery, and I was like, oh, if we increase volume, will you give us, like, discounts? And they said they would. So, I think we are accessible in terms of taste. I think we're true to Makgali in terms of our ingredients and brewing process. And I wouldn't say affordable to, like, all of America necessarily, but if in the markets that we're currently targeting, I think we're affordable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're saying the plastic bottle marketing will not make it beyond the Korean community, and for people that are unfamiliar with it, it has like an image of the fruit, Korean text. So if you're not Korean, you can't read it.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk about the design of the Makgali can, which when my friends and I drank it, we were like, oh, this is, like, so different and, you know, not at all what we expected. And what was the inspiration behind that? And what did you want to convey with that kind of branding?
So I knew branding would be the most important thing because that's why people, like, will try a new drink from what I know in the industry. So I didn't know what I wanted. I just, I talked to a few designers and I was like, okay, this is my challenge. I'm launching a a new category, a new brand. All I know is that I want people to want to reach for it on the shelf, and I want it to stand out on the shelf. And I want it's like a premium brand because it's going to be high quality products. And I might want the color white in there because I think when people see it in a cup, they get really scared and really turned off. But if the can's opaque, maybe unconsciously, if it's like a white can, then maybe it's kind of like a primer.
Yeah, like you're expecting something milky looking.
Yeah. Or, I don't know, just like the whiteness of a can. And it's also not, like, other beer brands, like, I don't think there's any who, like, put themselves in white cans.
Mm-hmm.
So I talked with a few designers, but we found one who had designed a sake for the American market, a premium sake. And I was like, oh, that's exactly our mission. Maybe he can understand. Maybe he understands some of these challenges. So, yeah, his name is Joe Doucette, and he, his whole design aesthetic is very minimal, clean. So he presented a few different ideas to us, and because Mako's unfiltered, the rice sediments fall to the bottom, and it's even more than, like, hazy beer, or, like, those, like, IPAs, like, milk, hazy IPAs. So you in Korea, the PET bottles, it's made so it's like shaken. They have these special caps that breathe, so you could shake it and it doesn't really explode.
Mm.
So I was like, oh, I'm kind of scared. I don't know if you shake a can, what happens to it? Because yes, it happens with the beer, but Makgeolli is a little bit different, the texture and the carbonation level. So maybe it won't explode, maybe it will. But we decided to make the label upside down. So at least you would turn the label upside down to look at it, and then the rice sediments will fall to the top. So he made a symbol for us, which was like this diagonal stripe. So whether our can was upside down or right side up, our brand like sign would stay intact.
Yeah.
So yeah, our first few cans were upside down, but with this new brewery, they forgot.
Are you going to bring it back after? That's a really great idea.
We're thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a bit scared because it's also unprecedented, and I'm scared that our container of cans will be held at customs and not let in because we're regulated by the FDA, and they don't have a clear answer for us whether we could bring that in or not.
Mm. Just having the labels upside down.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I don't know if I want to risk that. And we're also too small to risk that now. Maybe if we have, like, $1 million lying around, right? And plenty of inventory, we could do that. But, yeah, you know. Maybe parts of our label upside down. Or, like, something like this where it's, like, both right side up and upside down.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, so it sounds like you are on kind of the still... You're not yet on the other side. You're kind of presenting a lot of new, unprecedented things to the market. And so what do you think it means for our future of food that you're introducing Makgeolli to an American audience and it's not a niche Asian spirit?
Well, I don't know. I mean, like, I'm taking a risk and hoping that it will go beyond a niche Asian spirit, but it could very well just stay inside the Korean community. But looking around and seeing what other founders are creating in the food and beverage space, I think ethnic food and beverage is turning mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's only because I'm privileged and living in Manhattan and we're ahead of most trends, and maybe the rest of, you know, America's not ready for that yet, but at least from what I see, people are now, you know, because of social media and I don't know, maybe millennials just don't save now and they like to spend and travel and, you know, experience life. They're a lot more open to other cultures and they enjoy it immensely. Or if they can't afford to travel, they do it through food and culture. So, I think it is with the changing times and, you know, people are open-minded, like, the world is evolving. Everything is interracial now. I'm hoping that my hypothesis where this can enter, mainstream holds true.
And right now, are they only available in New York?
So we launched in New York and opened up LA. And we're just kind of in northern Jersey where it borders New York. But we're in talks with a distributor to go to San Fran and Las Vegas. And I'm also, I have some inquiries from like Michigan and Tennessee. So
yeah, so for now, if people are listening to this and want to find Maku at their stores, which stores are like a good place to find them?
It's very hyper-local. It's kind of smaller bodegas. But up till now, I've been doing sales by myself. So it's just been kind of like knocking on doors and cold calls. So we have a store locator on our website, but we just signed with a distributor, and the reason I did that was because we had commitment from like a large chain that if we were to switch to a distributor that they work with, they would start carrying us. And I don't want to reveal that yet because you never know when it comes to business, but I'm hoping that in the next few months that it'll definitely be available more widely.
It's really exciting.
Okay,
well, thank you for joining me today, Carol.
Thanks for having me.
Meant to be Eaten is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awali, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.